If you have questions and stuff that's coming up, make little notes because we will have a time. I had somebody ask me a great question in the break, and I just, because I didn't have time to answer it then, I thought we'd just ask it later because it's good. All right, so we got, yeah, we're good on time. We're on page 10. Here's the danger of that last little session I did. Is that it seems once you've understood about misattribution, right, and like how different cultures misunderstand each other, and then you've gotten some of those tools, some of those frames, like how it seems like maybe this is just easy. Right? It seems like, hey, well, we just figure out how the culture works and we don't be offended, and that should be good, right? But it turns out it's not. Like, knowing that is nice, and it can help you, but I think that's maybe like 10% of this journey is like understanding a little bit about those things. It's important, but this conversation is hard. I mean, Mikosa said it, right? It's awkward. It's tiring. She doesn't know if she wants to engage in it because it, you know, gets your feelings hurt, get misunderstood. So I want to spend a little bit of time giving some texture to just why this is hard. Okay? Just what makes this conversation difficult to have? Because it can seem like it should be simple. Like, do we all agree everybody's equal in God's sight, right? And are we all willing to maybe, if somebody has different preferences, we're willing to put up with those differences a little bit? Okay, done, good, let's go home. But then it's not. It's not that easy. So I'm going to give a few answers to why this is hard, and then Lake Hugh's really going to dive deep and start talking about our identity. Because that's really what makes this hard, is this question of identity. Let me start this with three American myths. Loving across differences in America, particularly this is for white people in America, though not exclusively, but just particularly for white people, is hard because we have three myths that we believe are true. And if these myths were true, it would make loving across differences easy. But these are not true. These myths are false. And believing that they're true makes loving across racial differences difficult. Now, they're not there yet. Good. These three myths are ideals. And they're not bad ideals. They're just not true. If they were true, it would be okay. I don't think anybody would be against these things being true. They're just not true, but we think they're true. We pretend they're true. And in pretending they're true, it makes it really hard for us to learn and understand people who are different from us. The first American myth is equality. The idea that we all have equal opportunity, we all have equal chance in life to move forward. That's an American belief. We value equality, and so we think that everybody has an equal shot. And so when somebody doesn't achieve, or somebody doesn't get somewhere, or something, like, we just think, what's your problem? We're all equal. What? So I just use this example. This is now a 3 or 4 year old example. We had Lent. We don't do Lent at our church anymore. You know why we don't do Lent? This is a tangent. But we figured out in Minnesota, it's okay to take some time to fast, to give things up, and to think about our own sinfulness. February and March is a really bad time to do that in Minnesota. You know what I mean? Like, we're already, like, deprived and faced with our own sinfulness in March. We don't need Lent's help. So we just quit. We'll do Lent in, like, you know, September or something. But we did Lent. And so Lake Hugh and I, we fasted something. I don't remember what. I probably didn't do very good at fasting it because I hate fasting. And we decided we were going to pray about something. And what we were going to pray about at the time, it was where our fourth grader, who's now in seventh grade, where our fourth grader was going to go to high school. Because that was going to have make a difference in terms of where we lived. And so we were like, where are we going to move? And how's that going to relate to church? So it was a big question where she's going to go to high school and what's academically going to be a good thing for her. And so we said, here, we're going to fast for 40 days for Lent, with the big question being, where does the Lord want us to send our daughter to high school? And the idea being, of course, we would move wherever we needed to move in order for her to go to high school at the place that we felt like the Lord told us to go to send her to high school. Okay? Now let's think about her, and then let's take somebody who lives, we're in northeast Minneapolis, right across the river is North Minneapolis, which is probably in this part of the country, it's the biggest center of sort of urban poverty. It's a very multi-ethnic neighborhood, about 50% African American, it's like 20% Latino, and then there's a growing Hmong population. Some white people live over there, not many. The schools aren't very good, and not a lot of people haven't had much opportunity or education. So let's take a fourth grader who's living over there. Could be whatever ethnic group, but just, and they look around and nobody they know has a college degree, okay? And nobody around them really values education very much because nobody's seen like the fruits of education, at least not many people. And the school I used to teach over there is not real good. So you go to school, there's just like a lot of chaos, a lot of, you know. Okay, so let's just take those two fourth graders. One is living in a space where there's very low value for education. School's not very good. Don't see many examples of education. And let's take my fourth grader, whose parents, when she was in fourth grade, fasted for 40 days to ask God where she should go to high school with full intention to move wherever God told them to send her to high school so she could go to school there. Which kid's got a better shot at high school? I mean, are we even close? Like, it's, right? So if my kid has a certain outcome in life, whether it's financially, educationally, culturally, and then that other kid has a certain outcome in life, did they put in the same amount of effort? Were they equally smart? They didn't start at the same place. And so one of the things we have to do when we love across differences is just come to terms with the fact that different groups are getting different spaces because they had different opportunities. The myth of equality creates a lot of judgment toward groups that might not achieve certain things. So we have to understand it's a myth. It's not true. It's a nice ideal. Do you follow me? I mean, it's not like, certainly we could aim at equality as a society, that'd be fine, but we're kidding if we pretend like it exists on the front end. The second American myth is the myth of individualism, and that is similar to equality, the idea that everybody falls and rises on their own merits. That whatever I accomplish, I deserve. If I'm a upper middle class suburbanite. I'm a suburbanite now. We moved to the suburbs. That's hard for me inside, but we're dealing with it. Why am I an upper middle class suburbanite who makes a good paycheck and has a minivan and can afford to take vacations? Because I deserve it. I worked hard. And if somebody else is struggling in life, his marriage isn't going very well, and maybe like their finances are kind of a mess, and why is that the case for them? Well, they screwed up. I deserve what I got, and you deserve what you got. That's just not true. Right? I mean, my mom homeschooled me. She had a terrible education. She homeschooled me until she couldn't do the math anymore. It's fifth grade. And then we moved to a super rich suburb of Chicago and lived in the slums of the suburb, which was nice, but it was the slum of the suburb, you follow me? So it was middle class, but I thought it was lower class. So I could go to the rich, 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 rich high school that other people paid their property taxes to make that school really great. And so now, like, I have a good education, and I think I'm really smart because I think I'm really smart, but I'm not really smart because I'm really smart. I'm really smart because my mom taught me math till fifth grade and then moved me to the rich suburbs. That's why I'm smart. The last myth, and again, these are real similar, is that we live in a meritocracy, which is similar to what I just said. We get what we deserve. And so whatever we see other people have, we think they earned that. And these myths lead to a lot of unspoken judgment, to a lot of unspoken resentment. There's a lot I could say politically, but I won't. But we have to come to terms with these, and for white people, it means coming to terms that, like, in a lot of cases, and I'm not saying universally, because everybody's got a different story, I probably don't actually deserve my paycheck. A lot of the things that I'm proud of, I probably didn't earn. And a lot of people who are struggling don't actually deserve to be struggling. That's a little bruise to the white ego. When I say this to some, now, actually, there's been a lot of talk about privilege in the last few years, and so these realities have actually gotten a little more play in the media. But like 3-4 years ago, when I would say this to like a white guy, they would lose their mind. Because their identity was built on, I earned this. You know? I did better than that person over there. And when you cut that out and say, maybe you didn't deserve that. Maybe you didn't earn that. Maybe you're just lucky. You just won the, like, birth lottery. And you got what you got because you're lucky. That messed with your identity. People, particularly white dudes, because we're at the top of the pack. That's part of why it's hard. Those three things. Still doing good on time, right? Yeah. And then I'll do this quick and then. Here's another reason it's hard. I want to talk about three levels of conversation. And you're going to have to follow me for a bit. I'm going to tie this back to this racial question in a minute. So go on a journey with me. This was done by some Harvard researchers. He said there's three levels of difficult conversations. And the first level is the least helpful level. It's the what happened conversation. We're going to do a husband and a wife, okay? And they're arguing about who cleans the house more. Any husbands and wives get in that fight? The what happened level is, I always do the dishes. You never do the dishes. What do you mean? I just did the dishes last night. I put them in the dishwasher. Well, I did them last week, and you didn't even notice. And you left your cup out, and you left the dishes out. No, like 2 weeks ago. I've been doing it every week on Mondays for 3 months, and you didn't even see. You know this fight? Does that fight ever resolve itself? The what happened level will never. It wouldn't resolve itself if you had video cameras in your house. You would, like, dispute the interpretation of the videos. The second level of conversation is the emotions level of conversation. It's about what we feel. So maybe it's not so much that whatever happened with the dishes yesterday, I was already feeling a little hurt by you, and I was tired, and all I wanted was to come home to a clean house, and I came home exhausted from my day at work, and the kitchen was a mess, and I was angry and frustrated and resentful of you. Does this make sense? That very well may be that that's what's really going on, and we need to deal with the emotions. I'm sorry about your bad day yesterday. And I could have been more sensitive. I could have done the dishes so you could come home to a clean house. That's the emotions level. And what these researchers found, I actually talked to one of them. What these researchers found was that sometimes a difficult conversation could get resolved at the what happened level if there was just factual difference and it just got fixed. Sometimes the emotional thing would fix it, but some conversations, they'd get into the emotions and it didn't seem to make any difference. You know, I felt this when you didn't do the dishes. I felt this, but they didn't. It just kept, going. And they discovered that there was a deeper level underneath the emotions, and this was the identity level of conversation. And the identity level of conversation is when the conversation is about who I am. I feel like you're saying I'm a bad wife. I feel like I'm not being respected as a husband. I feel like you don't think I'm a good spouse. Well, all the I feel statements in the world don't work when you feel like you're not a good spouse, or you're not a good friend, or you're not a good partner. And until the identity thing gets ironed out, forget the emotions and forget the what happened. Well, let me just tie this back. When we're talking about race, we're talking about identity immediately. We're immediately going to the hardest thing to talk about. I'm talking about how I perceive myself as a white guy. That's not safe. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's just not safe. As soon as I'm talking about who I am as a woman, who I am as an Asian woman, who I am as a what, like, I would rather argue about the dishes.
Do the intent impacting now later.
Yeah. Here's my one tip that helps with this. As we deal with what happened, as we deal with emotions and identity, is to focus in all these conversations as we try to understand each other. This is money. Write this down. Focus on impact, not intent. Focus on impact, not intent. Here's what I mean by intent. Intent is what I meant to say. I didn't mean to disrespect you as a pastor. I didn't mean to imply that you are dumber than me. I didn't mean to say something that you found racist. I didn't mean it to be offensive, right? That's intent. Here's like the weirdest thing in the world, but it's true. It really doesn't matter what you meant. It doesn't matter. And in fact, I don't think you know what you meant. I don't think we usually know what we intended to say. That's like actually a really deep philosophical question, what we meant to say. God knows what we meant to say. If something has an impact on somebody, that's what matters. If I didn't mean to offend you, but you're offended, guess what matters? You're offended. If I didn't mean to stereotype you, if I didn't mean to make you cry, but you're crying, guess what matters? You're crying. We spend a lot of time on intent talk. I didn't mean to say that. I didn't intend to do that. I intended to be a good person. Intentions are pretty irrelevant. Impact is what makes a big difference. And when we're dealing on the level of identity, if I violated your identity, I violated your identity, and you do not care what I meant to do. And I'm going to have to deal with what that impact was and quit trying to be self-righteous about what my intent was. Does that make sense? Okay, that's why this stuff's hard. And LAQ's going to take you on a journey even deeper.
So let's talk about identity then. I mean, if that's such a big deal, then what's going on with identity? So if you look at this little chart, one of the things I want to talk about is how we develop a sense of identity formation, like identity formation. How do we develop that? How do we respond to the world out of that place of our core belief about who we are? So you notice you've got two axes. And the way that we develop who we are is oftentimes, I mean, just in all the reading I do, it's in relationship to or in contrast. So it's either we're similar to or we're different from the people around us, right? So label this top, this little line going up, group. This is your sense of group identity. And then across the bottom, okay. Then across the bottom, as you develop your sense of, like, who am I in relation to your group, that's how your self-identity grows. So as your sense of group grows, how you are like or unlike someone around you, so does your sense of self grow, right? So this bottom line going across is self. Now then I want you to identify along this line of group, belonging. Label that belonging. So you go along that line and you have a sense of belonging. When you feel like you are similar to other people, or you can relate to other people, you feel like you have a sense of belonging to a group, okay? And then
like
along...
You go here and you look like acoustic guitars?
Yeah. Well, okay, whatever. and then along the bottom, when you have a grow as a sense, like having a sense of self, you have self-esteem, okay? So label the self-esteem. Now, if you guys did the little worksheets, there was a sense of autobiography. You know, there's lots of different ways that we think about ourselves and how we relate to other people. So, you know, like growing up, I'll just give myself an example. So you figure out, oh, gender. So I'm a girl. I noticed that right away because, you know, there are people who are boys, right? So that's a basic one. I'd noticed that, hey, I'm Chinese because my parents told me all the time I'm Chinese. I don't speak English. I came from Vietnam. I was born in Vietnam. I'm a refugee. So all of those right away. I'm not American. I speak a different language. I didn't speak English, and I didn't have ESL. So as I'm developing this sense of, like, how am I similar or different from other people, I have all of these right away, all of these differences, really big ones. Religiously, I'm not Christian, so, you know, my parents are Buddhist, but I'm agnostic, and so I don't fit with my parents or my friends. And then as you go, there's socioeconomics, you know, being a refugee. I was much, much lower class than my, you know, friends. And I was super smart. And so I was, and I got, you know, into AP classes. And the thing I noticed was in my AP classes, everybody was upper middle class and most everybody was white. And so I totally didn't fit in with, I had to learn a lot of nonverbal cues about what it meant to have class differences. Okay, so here's your line, and you notice there are arrows, right? As you experience more of the world, as you grow, you're going to notice more and more similarities and differences from between yourself and other people. Now, remember I said that this is the axis of belonging, and this is the axis of self-esteem. As your arrows grow, because you encounter more and more different people, you kind of feel pulled along these two lines, because you want to belong, but sometimes in order to belong, you can't be yourself. That's what I experienced. So growing up for myself, once I hit college, what I had noticed was that in order for me to fit in, because I was just in such a predominantly white place where I wasn't like my peers, I repressed a whole bunch of who I was in order to fit with who my friends were, so I could have a sense of belonging. So then I had a really sense of low self-esteem, right? So if I'm up here with high belonging and high group identity, I'm over here with a low sense of self-esteem. Well, then when I hit to college, you know, I went to University of Illinois, like Gino, and it was more diverse than where I went to school. What I realized was, like, oh, I don't fit in with, like, I left my parents, and I'm not trying to please my parents all the time now, but I don't fit in with my white friends all the time, but I don't fit in with the Asian American community. Like, many of them came from Chicago, and they had groups of friends. I didn't fit in with the Korean American Association or the Asian American Association or the Chinese American Association. It's just, I was like, they call them Twinkies. I was like a yellow on the outside and white on the inside. It's like a terrible phrase, but it was accurate. And that one of the things that I encountered was just a sense of, like, I don't like myself. I don't know who I am. And so what I did was, and this is a very, you guys have probably seen this, when someone is really trying to figure out who they are and they feel so different from their group, they snap. And what happens is, because these are nice, solid lines, you want to stick close to them. And so I snapped from having a strong sense of group identity and wanting to have a sense of self-esteem. And so I rejected a whole lot of people. And so what I did was I became friends with people who were just like me, women of color who grew up in predominantly white spaces. We got each other. Like, I knew their language, they knew mine. We could share stories, we laughed at the same things. Well, then I became a Christian. And this was the first thing that God really just, like, honed in on and said, this is not okay. This is not okay to reject people, and it's not okay to reject yourself. And so there's this dot out here. This is where Christ calls us, I think, to a place where we are willing to go, where we're like, I can submit my life to the Lord and receive a sense of value and worth from him and believe I have a sense of worth. I can have self-esteem, and also a sense of being able to embrace all the people who are a part of my group, all the people who are a part of my life. But here's the thing that's really hard about this space. There's a lot of white space here. There's a lot of ambiguity, not a lot of clarity, a lot of things you got to figure out. And it stretches you. It stretches you really far from this line, right? So sometimes you feel like, where do I belong? Like in all of these, in all of this space, where do I belong? And how do I feel good about myself? And so I think it's one of the most powerful things when we really submit our identity to Jesus. And that's how we can grow. And the more people you know, the bigger this graph goes. And it just keeps going and keeps going. And so I think we have choices. Like we have the choice in front of us to either be people who snap and reject or snap and repress, right? So we can repress or we can reject. Or we can go and be transformed by the love of Christ. It be what the church, I believe, has been meant to be and be a blessing to all people, all nations, to all of our neighbors, and to be healed. And so this is the thing with identity is like we're really tempted. We are really tempted to stick close to either the group and reject ourselves or feel good about ourselves and reject our group. And we just really have to fight that. And I think the church is like the one place where we can really, really do this well. And so so that's the thing with identity. And this goes along all sorts of lines. So think about this one. All right.
And the attempt.
And I was talking to Michael yesterday, and he just said, like, how do I grow well in this? When you're part of the majority culture, you have the option of going to one of the other two. You don't have to stay out in an ambiguous land. To be a reconciler is, as a person of privilege, is to choose to live in ambiguous land. You don't so much have a choice living where you live. Nope. Unless you're just going to be really angry and shut the world out. You have to live in ambiguous land. But white people have to decide to do it.
Yeah.
And not give up because it's hard. So, good. We're going to do the privilege walk?
Yes. Okay, so in order to help prep us for the video and to kind of tie together some of the things that, you know, we have been talking about that Jeff talked about in terms of the ideals that are, if we believe that are already real, they're not real, they're myths. In terms of like the equality of opportunity, what we're going to do is I'm actually just take a few minutes, and so we'll give a little like 5-10 minutes for you guys to fill this out. There's 31 questions.
Page 12 and 13.
Yeah, page 12 and 13. And what I want you to do is go through the questions, and we're going to score ourselves. So if the statement is true about you, I want you to give yourself a point. Some statements could be partially true for you, like in terms of like part of your life. Like I know for me, part of my life that's been true, and part of my life it wasn't true. Give yourself like a half a point. And if it's not true for you, give yourself zero. We're going to take 5 minutes to do that. And then once we're done with that, we will...
And then actually, add it up and have a total score.
Yes. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. And the folks who are still sitting but are tallying, you guys can move whenever... we're ready. But what we're going to do is, so each row, I'm going to give a value. So starting from the back. So if you had 2 or less, you can sit down in the back row. If you had 4 or less, which is actually me, we'd be sitting in the second to the last row. Okay, how about 6? Anybody have 6 or less? Come to the third one. Yep, right there. No, the one more. Yes. All right, 8. Anyone have between 6 and 8? Okay, how about 10? 10 would be the next row. 9 or 10? Okay. How about 11 or 12? So which row was that one? The 6, 8? Yep. Okay, 13 or 14? 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 20, 21, or what did I say? 21, 22, sorry, 21, 22. 23, 24, right? That's where I'm at, 23, 24. Okay, 25, 26, 27, 28. All right, 29, 30. and 31.
If you're 31, you get to come talk.
Yeah, if you're 31, you just come to the stage. All right. Now, you guys have kind of watched the progression as we've gone. And so this is a sort of visual, physical representation of what we are talking about when we are trying to describe what it means that our country is not, like, equality is a myth. Like, we don't start in the same places. Like, a lot of these questions, there are things that you don't personally have control over, that you can't personally change. And so this is about the system that we live in. And so just look around you. Just kind of look at where this church is at and, you know, what this country, this is a pretty good representation of what this country, where this is at. And there are probably emotions that some people feel. This is one of the things where if you're a person of color, this is actually probably one of the most awkward places to have to be, like, this is one of the most awkward exercises, because you already know that this is true. Like, if you're sitting at the front, like, think about this as a race, right? If you're at the front, and this is where you started, like, you probably not, like, the, even this image of, like, you're looking at the front of the stage, right? Who do you see behind you? Well, you just see who's beside you. But the people who are at the back, they see everybody who's in front of them. They see how far they have to go. How far they have to go, and how many steps they have to take in order to get to the stage. And so, yeah. Okay, why don't you take a minute and go back to your seats? And then I'm just going to have Gino and Michael, I'm going to have you come up. Because I just like to get reactions. And I like to have you guys just even respond. So we don't have anything scripted. It just says we wanted to have a bit of a opportunity to talk, to respond, to express. Like, just the things that we've experienced this morning, the things that we've heard, this particular privilege walk. I don't know, Jeff, is there anything we've been talking up here, is there anything you want to say real quick? Okay. Gino, do you want to? Okay. All right. It would be great then if anybody had responses, I would love for you guys to come up and share them as you guys were going through that privilege walk. Anyone? Anyone have any questions? Is it bad? No, I don't think it's bad.
I'd like to know what you felt. What did it feel like to just watch people walk to their rows?
I've just felt like really all day long, I just feel weepy about just the issues. And in one sense, it felt really hard watching people walk to their rows. The thing I found myself wanting to do was sit down with everybody and compare, like, what questions couldn't you put a one in front of? Like I just wanted to understand it more.
What did other people feel? Just, you can stand up where you're at and just say it. What did it feel like to do that? That the leaders were in the front? That's good. What else did you feel or notice?
Here. A lot of the people that are here are people that I go to church with every weekend, and I consider them my peers, my friends, whatever. But when we sat in the rows, I realized that because of my upbringing, because of my circumstance, it was different. I was a few rows back, farther than I thought I would have been. So it was an eye-opener.
I would say as a person of color in this room, during that exercise, it was interesting and a little bit delightful to co-discover these realities with. I've had these conversations many, many times, and it's just hard unless you have a questionnaire in front of you to tick off the ways that privilege actually, you know, benefits one over the other, and to be able to co-discover these realities in such a very, you know, visual way was very important. As I saw the back rows fill up with the few people of color in this room, I thought this is a very helpful way to articulate things that are just hard to discuss and to articulate outside of an exercise like that. So I thought it was really good to see that together.
I was embarrassed to be so far forward and to realize that the people in the far back are those that perhaps for us near the front, we take one step and the job is ours. Perhaps back there, it's a long process and it would be very difficult to be back there and looking through all the rest of the congregation, not having that opportunity, that others didn't.
How many people who were near the front felt some level of guilt? It's like a really interesting thing to deal with. People call it white guilt. In some ways, it's unavoidable, and in some ways, it's unhelpful because it's kind of self-centered, you know? Like, I'm sitting at the front, and what I'm thinking about is how guilty I feel. What am I going to do with that guilt? It's weird. It's like narcissistic, but it's kind of true. You know, it's not wrong to have privilege. Follow me. I think it's wrong that there is privilege, but it's not wrong to have it. You were just born with it. The question is just, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to live out on that dot that's really far from both ends? Or just try to forget that this happened because it's kind of awkward and not real fun. So I think it's normal to feel that guilt. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it. But then the question is like, do I choose to live in this space where I'm going to do something with it? Or am I just going to kind of feel it and then try to get rid of it because it's not real pleasant to think about?
I think also it's important to realize, as Jeff said, that these questions, all of them deal with stuff that you didn't have anything to do with. And so, you know, as a sober, you know, thinking soberly about this, I don't necessarily want the people in the front to feel bad about being in the front. Because most of that had nothing to do with you. But I do want you to not argue with me that you're on row one and I'm back there on row 30, you know? And in the same way that what you have access to was not your fault, or at least entirely your fault, when you look back and see me on the 30th row, don't assume that I did something or I should be doing something in order to be on row one. Does that make sense what I'm saying? And so we don't need you to be embarrassed about your privilege because you had nothing to do with that, by and large. But we want you to extend that same awareness of, you know, a sense of faultlessness with regard to where you ended up. We'd like you to extend that same degree of consideration to us.
So, Gino, if you have privilege, how do you walk in that privilege? How do you do, you know, yes, if you have conversations, you gave us a couple practicals there of how you don't want us to respond, but what are some really practical couple of things that a person of privilege can do in walking in that privilege?
Well, I'll speak mostly for myself. I get annoyed with like the white guilt. I get annoyed. I don't think it's very helpful. It doesn't really serve a purpose. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help yourself. And so, I just think that I just want to give you some freedom to release that, any sense of that, because it's not helpful. It doesn't move me. It doesn't benefit anybody else. And frankly, I just don't want anybody to be guilty or, you know, operate out of that as it relates to privilege. But I think the most pronounced thing that we can do is just be aware and acknowledge that, yes, I've had a head start to this race. I'm a few legs ahead. And while you may not be personally able to invite me to the front row to sit up next to you in every sense, sometimes you can bring people from the back row up. Now, that doesn't change my answers to the questionnaire, but, you know, sometimes we hear conversations about you can use your power and your privilege and your influence and your voice to help those who are voiceless and powerless, or so far back that they can't be heard, or they don't have influence. And so what I'd like to see my people of privilege, my friends of privilege and power, when they're at the table and they can advocate for people who haven't made it there yet, or people who don't have a voice, or people who don't have influence, or they can push back against some of the things that are said that are perhaps misinformed or even wrong, I just expect my friends with power to use that power to help those who don't have it. And so that can happen a whole lot of ways. I don't have a whole lot of specific examples, but I think it's helpful to start thinking along those lines.
Can I take the next one? I've thought about this tons. One thing that's, I think, helpful to recognize is that white American culture is a fixing culture. Fixing. We fix things. So if I'm sitting in the front row, the first thing I want to know is, how do I solve this? Give me if I said push-ups, you'd probably start doing push-ups. If you do push-ups, you will solve race problems. Ready? Give me 50 push-ups. I mean, white people would start doing push-ups, you know? Some of it is just sitting with this reality and like gaining understanding and not running away from the feeling, really. And not sitting in guilt, but just like a big part of this thing is lament. It's like really sad. Mm-hmm. I'm taking a class now about theology of race, and I'm learning things about like the history of systemic racism that I can't study for my class for more than an hour at a time. I like lose it. I mean, like, you know, it's unbelievable. And I want to look away. But it's sitting in there, which is sitting with the Lord.
Right.
The Lord is always, Jesus always picks the oppressed. I want to be clear. Jesus is in the back row. That's the only advantage of being in the back row is that's where Jesus hangs out. You know? If we're in the front row, the disadvantage is that we're further away from Jesus. It's just true. Like, we read the Bible. Mary gives the greatest sermon in the Bible. It's unbelievable. Book of Luke. When the angel comes and says, you're pregnant with the Messiah. You know the first thing she says? She says, magnify the Lord, O my soul. God is pleased with me. God has brought his Messiah in the world. And the next thing she says is, the high are going low and the low are going high. The rich are getting poor and the poor are getting rich. This whole thing is getting turned upside down because Jesus is here now. Hmm. We know him from the Catholics and say the Hail Mary a little more often because she tells us what this thing means. Sorry, I'm preaching. I'm on a stage.
So I got a very practical example. My wife is white. Some of you saw that by the picture. And what she says to me after we've been together almost 13 years now, she says that her worldview and the way she looks at the world, particularly how she looks at, views her privilege and minorities and people of color is completely different since we've been doing life together. And that we've had some fun times, but we've had some not so fun times trying to figure each other out. And so one of the things that we often talk about is just my worldview, which it shapes how I do things. My wife, if she wants to return something to the store, she doesn't have a bag. Sometimes she doesn't have a receipt. And she's just walking through the store to return something. I would never do that. I got the stuff that I'm going to return. Like, I got it in two bags. I got the receipt out because I don't want anybody to say anything to me just because of how I've been socialized and how I grew up. And so we're aware of those differences. And so my wife in her office, she works for the Park District in our city, and she realizes that there are hardly any people of color in her office. And so what she's been doing lately is she's been advocating that there be people of color actively pursued in the hiring pools of all these jobs that have become available. And as she's begun to not only advocate for this, she's helping her superiors understand not to interpret all these behaviors and some of the cultural things through the lenses of just sort of whiteness. And she's been helping to say, no, you're interpreting this as a negative thing. That's just kind of like, that's a cultural thing. And so don't count that against a person because they don't dress like you or they don't talk like you. Well, she's at the table, and there's nobody at the table to say those things. And so she realizes that her privilege and her, you know, she has power. And so since there's no people of color at that table, she's using her spot at the table to speak up and to advocate for people who are not there. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so in this church, you think about who's in charge here? Who makes the decisions? Who sets the culture? Who determines who gets hired or who gets fired? How the money gets spent? Who comes in to preach and what type of music we play and all these sorts of things? And so it's probably the case that that group is largely white, right?
Yes.
And so what those largely white group of people, particularly those who are in the room right now and who see, you know, so this visual display of how privilege and power works, it's upon those people now to begin to advocate and say, okay, how does this series, how is this going to land on the people of color in our community? Until they get at the table, like, what can we do now to advocate for them and to speak for them? And what also can we do to invite more of them to the table to help shape the culture here? So this is a few examples of how this
That's
this
really
works.
Helpful. And I think when Jeff was just talking about when he said Jesus, my heart just kind of leaped for joy, because I just think as a person of privilege, bringing Jesus into that place with us and saying, help me understand how this lens makes me treat people, and how do I treat people more like you are treating them, how you see them, Jesus, and, you know, just asking him to change us from the inside out.
One thing that I would advocate for is if you go into the community and you volunteer, I would really encourage you, if this is something on your heart, to find a place where you can sit and volunteer or serve or work under the leadership of someone who is a minority. There are things that you can learn, things that you will uncover in your own heart of, like, what does it mean to have good conflict resolution skills? What does it mean to be a person in authority? Like all sorts of cultural assumptions that you had that might get turned upside down, and really, like, reimagine it. Like, you might reimagine the way that leadership works, and you might reimagine what it means to be a person who is an effective and good leader that might not be so culturally biased. But you have to sit under someone's leadership, and that it's surprisingly difficult. It is surprisingly difficult for people of privilege to do that. And so I would encourage that. I mean, there might not be tons of opportunities, but if you could go find them, it's out there in your community. And so I would just, that's a practical thing.
Yeah.